content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the health section, How Much Less to Worry About Long COVID Now, by Catherine J. Wu. Compared with the worst days of the pandemic, when the vaccines and antivirals were non-existent or scarce, when more than 10,000 people around the world were dying each day, when long COVID largely went unacknowledged, even as countless people felt chronically ill, the prognosis for the average infection with this coronavirus has clearly improved. In the past 4 years, the likelihood of severe COVID has massively dropped. Even now, as the United States barrels through what may be the second largest wave of SARS-CoV-2 infections, the rate of death remains near their all-time low. And although tens of thousands of Americans are still being hospitalized with COVID each week, emergency rooms and intensive care units are no longer routinely being forced into crisis mode. Long COVID, too, appears to be less common outcome of new infections than it once was. But where the drop in severe COVID incidence is clear and prominent, the drop in long COVID cases is neither as certain nor as significant. In a way, the shrinking of severe disease has made long COVID's dangers more stark. Nowadays, long COVID to me still feels like the biggest risk for most people, Matt Durstenfeld, a cardiologist at UC San Francisco, told me, in part because it does not spare the young and healthy as readily as severe disease does. Most of the experts I spoke with for this story do think the average SARS-CoV-2 infection is less likely to unfurl into long COVID than it once was. Several studies and data sets support this idea. Physicians running clinics told me that, anecdotally, they're seeing that pattern play out among their patient rosters, too. The number of referrals coming into Alexandra Yount's long COVID clinic at Children's National in Washington, D.C., for instance, has been steadily dropping in the past year, and the wait list seems to be shortening. The situation is similar, other experts told me, among adult patients at Yale and UCSF. Lisa Sanders, an internal medicine physician who runs a clinic at Yale, told me that more recent cases of long COVID appear to be less debilitating than ones that manifested in 2020. People who got the earliest versions definitely got whacked the worst, she said. That's reflective of how our relationship to COVID has changed overall. In the same way that immunity can guard a body against COVID's most severe acute forms, it may also protect against certain kinds of long COVID. Most experts consider long COVID to be an umbrella term for many related but separate syndromes. Once wised up to a virus, our defenses become strong and fast-acting, more able to keep infection from spreading and lingering, as it might in some long COVID cases. Courses of illness also tend to end more quickly, with less viral buildup, giving the immune system less time or reason to launch a campaign of friendly fire on other tissues, another potential trigger of chronic disease. In line with that logic, a glut of studies has shown that vaccination, especially recent and repeated vaccination, can reduce a person's chances of developing long COVID. There is near universal agreement on that. Zayed Al-Ali, the chief of research at VA St. Louis Healthcare System and a clinical epidemiologist at Washington University in St. Louis, told me. Some experts think that the antiviral use may be making a dent as well by decreasing the proportion of COVID cases that progress to severe disease, a risk factor for certain types of long COVID. But consensus on any of these points is lacking, especially on just how much, if at all, these interventions help. Experts are divided even on the effects of vaccines, which have the most evidence to back up their protective punch. Some studies find that they trim risk by 15%, others up to about 70%. Paxlovid, too, has become a point of contention. Although some analyses have shown that taking the antiviral early in infection helps prevent long COVID, others have found no effect at all. Any implication that we've tamed long COVID exaggerates how positive the overall picture is. Hannah Davis, one of the leaders of the patient-led research collaborative who developed long COVID during the pandemic's first months, told me that she's seen how the most optimistic studies get the most attention from the media and the public. With a topic as unwieldy and challenging to understand as this, Davis said, we still see overreactions to good news and underreactions to bad news. That findings are all over the place on long COVID isn't a shock. The condition still lacks a universal definition or a standard method of diagnosis. When recruiting patients into their studies, research groups can rely on distinct sets of criteria, inevitably yielding disparate and seemingly contradictory sets of results. With vaccines, for instance, the more wide-ranging set of potential long COVID symptoms a study looks at, the less effective shots may appear, simply because vaccines don't work on everything, Al Ali told me. Studying long COVID has also gotten tougher. The less attention there is on COVID, the less likely people are to associate long-term symptoms with it. Priya Dugal, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University, told me, fewer people are testing for the virus, and some physicians still don't believe in long COVID. That's what I hear a lot, Sanders told me. The fact that fewer new long COVID cases are appearing before researchers and clinicians could be in part driven by fewer diagnoses being made. Even if new cases of long COVID are less likely nowadays, the incidence rates haven't dropped to zero, and rates of recovery are slow, low, and still murky. At this point, people entering this category are at a greater rate than people are exiting this category, Michael Paluzzo, a long COVID researcher at UCSF, told me. The CDC's Household Pulse Survey, for instance, shows that the proportion of American adults reporting that they're currently dealing with long COVID has held steady, about 5 to 6%, for more than a year. Long COVID remains one of the most debilitating chronic conditions in today's world, and full recovery remains uncommon, especially if it seems for those who have been dealing with the disease for the longest. Exact numbers on recovery are tricky to come by for the same reason that it's difficult to pin down how effective preventatives are. Some studies report rates far more optimistic than others. David Putrino, a physical therapist who runs a long COVID clinic at Mount Sinai Health System, where he and colleagues have seen more than 3,000 long haulers since the pandemic's start, told me his best estimates err on the side of prognosis being poor. About 20% of Petrina's patients fully recover within the first few months, he told me. Beyond that, though, he routinely encounters people who experience only partial symptom relief, as well as a cohort that, no matter what we think to try, Putina told me, we can't even seem to stop them from deteriorating. Reports of higher recovery rates, Putrino and other experts said, might be conflating improvement with a return to baseline, or mistakenly assuming that people who stop responding to follow-ups are better. Davis also worries that recovery rates could drop. Some researchers and clinicians have noticed that today's new long COVID patients are more likely than earlier patients to come in with certain neurological symptoms, among them brain fog and dizziness, that they have linked to slower recovery trajectories. Lakshmi Santhoff, a pulmonary specialist at UCF, told me, in any case, recovery rates are still modest enough that long COVID clinics across the country, even ones that have noted a dip in demand, remain fully full. Currently, Putrina's clinic has a wait list of 3 to 6 months. The same is true for clinical trials investigating potential treatments. Any decrease in long COVID incidence may not last either. Viral evolution could always produce a new variant or subvariant with higher risks of chronic issues. The protective effects of vaccination may also be quite temporary, and the fewer people who keep up to date with their shots, the more porous immunity's safety net may become. In this way, kids, though seemingly less likely to develop long COVID overall, may remain worryingly vulnerable, Jantz told me, because they're born entirely susceptible and immunization rates in the youngest age groups remain extremely low. And yet, little kids who get long COVID may need to live with it the longest. Some of Jantz's patients have barely started grade school and have already been sick for 3+ years, half of their lives so far, or more. Long COVID can also manifest after repeat infection of SARS-CoV-2, and although several experts told me they think that each subsequent exposure poses less incremental risk, any additional exposure is worrisome. People all over the world are being exposed over and over again as the pathogen spreads with blistering speed, more or less year-round in populations that have mostly dropped mitigations and are mostly behind on annual shots when they're available. Additional infections can worsen the symptoms of people living with long COVID or yank them out of remission. Long COVID's inequities may also widen as marginalized populations, less likely to receive vaccines or antivirals, and more likely to be exposed to the virus, continue to develop the condition at higher rates. There's no question that COVID-19 has changed. The disease is more familiar. The threat of severe disease, although certainly not vanished, is quantitatively less now. But dismissing the dangers of the virus would be a mistake. Even if rates of new long COVID cases continue to drop for some time, Jantz pointed out, they will likely stabilize somewhere. These risks will continue to haunt us and incur costs that will keep adding up. Long COVID may not kill as directly as severe acute COVID has, but people's lives still depend on avoiding it, Putrino told me. At least their life as they know it right now. Our second article, Erasing Jewish History Will Not Help Palestinians. The assertion that Jesus was Palestinian is often made in an effort to negate Jewish history. By Peter Wehner. For Jews, the events of October 7th, the worst massacre of Jews on a single day since the Holocaust, were horrifying and traumatizing. But what has happened in the 3 months since is also deeply unsettling, though in a different way. Much of the world, rather than offering empathy and compassion for Israel, has turned on it. Hamas's malevolent actions helped produce a sharp rise in anti-Semitism and in anti-Israel rallies in cities across the world. Earlier this month, the International Court of Justice in The Hague began hearing South Africa's case accusing Israel of genocide in its war against Hamas, launched in reaction to the massacre. Israel was the victim of depraved attacks by an Iran-backed terror group determined to annihilate the world's only Jewish majority country, and yet it is Israel that is on the dock. We've seen this perverse phenomenon play out in other ways as well. During the Christmas holidays, Jesus was pulled into the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. In an Instagram post, U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez drew parallels between the persecutors of Jesus and modern-day Israel. Jesus was part of a targeted population being indiscriminately killed to protect an unjust leader's power, Ocasio-Cortez wrote. Thousands of years later, right-wing forces are violently occupying Bethlehem as similar stories unfold for today's Palestinians. She continued, "The high Christian holiday is about honoring the precious sanctity of a family that, if the story were to unfold today, would be Jewish Palestinians," she continued. She was not alone in drawing that parallel. On Christmas morning, Father Edward Beck, a Catholic priest and religion commentator, was asked on CNN about the pain and suffering taking place all over the world during the holiday season. What I'm so struck by is that the story of Christmas is about a Palestinian Jew. How often do you find those words put together? A Palestinian Jew, born into a time when his country was occupied, right? Beck said. I mean, you can't make up the parallels between our current world situation right now. On Boston Commons, a vandal went a step further, spray painting Jesus was Palestinian below a nativity scene. This claim is hardly new. In 2013, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, called Jesus a Palestinian messenger in his annual Christmas message. In 2019, Ocasio-Cortez's colleague Ilhan Omar shared a tweet by an academic who said this, "I was once asked by a relative who is a Palestinian Christian why the Christian right in America largely supports their oppression. Don't they know we're Christian too? Do they even consider us human? Don't they know Jesus was a Palestinian?" In fact, although many Palestinians today are Christians, Jesus himself was not one. He was born to Jewish parents in Judea. He lived as a Jew, and he died as a Jew. In the time of Jesus, Palestine didn't exist as a place, an entity, a word, or a concept. In the second century, Judea, which was the epicenter of large-scale Jewish rebellions against Roman rule, was renamed Syria Palestina, later simply Palestina by the Romans. The term Palestina was derived from Philistia, the name given by the Greeks to the land of the Philistines, the ancient enemies of the Israelites. The Philistines were not Arab, but Aegean. Rome's goal was to sever the connection between Judea and the Jews, to de-Judaize the land. It was an unsuccessful effort. Jews who first arrived in present-day Israel more than 3,000 years ago continue to maintain a presence in that land, especially in Jerusalem, the holiest city in Judaism, the location of the first and second temples, atop which the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock were later built, and in Hebron, the second holiest. So why does this matter? Because the assertion that Jesus was Palestinian is often made in an effort to negate Jewish history, to insist that only Palestinians and not Jews have claim to the land. This absolutist claim provides a seedbed for the radical belief that Jews do not deserve a country of their own, in even a part of their ancestral homeland. Even the more qualified claim that Jesus was a Palestinian Jew is often intended to make the same negationist point. Jews who lived in the Ottoman Empire and then British-occupied Palestine, to be sure, often used the term Palestinian to describe themselves. Former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir in a 1970 interview said, "I'm a Palestinian. From 21 to 48, I carried a Palestinian passport." But when Ocasio-Cortez calls Jesus a Jewish Palestinian, she is not trying to connect him to the likes of Golda Meir. None of this is to say that Palestinian Arabs are not indigenous to the land. Certainly they are. To deny that would be to play the same pernicious game that is played against the Jews. The Palestinians today are descendants of the Arabs who left Arabia and conquered Palestine and much of the known world 1,400 years ago. Surely 1,400 years is enough to establish a claim of indigeneity. Of course, to acknowledge that both Jews and Palestinians are indigenous to the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea is to shatter the widespread narrative that Israel is a settler colonial state, as well as a narrative advanced by some far-right Jews and Christians that Palestinians have no legitimate national claims of their own. If Israel is, as the historian Barbara Tuchman put it, the only nation in the world that is governing itself in the same territory, under the same name, and with the same religion and same language as it did 3,000 years ago, then the creation of the modern state of Israel can't be understood through the frame of colonization or imperialism. It was rather a case of an indigenous people returning home from exile, a people, it should be said, willing to live under a United Nations-sponsored partition plan in 1948 that many Jews at the time felt ceded too much land to an Arab polity with frontiers that were virtually indefensible. Israel accepted the compromise. The Arab world did not. The Arab states attacked, expressing confidence that they would annihilate the Jews. They failed in their war of extermination, but the wars kept coming, and keep coming. To better grasp how essential the denial of history has been to opponents of Israel, consider a story from Dennis Ross. The former Middle East envoy worked with President Bill Clinton to achieve a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians at Camp David in the winter of 2000. The only new idea Yasser Arafat raised at Camp David over the course of 15 days of negotiations, Ross has said, was that the temple didn't exist in Jerusalem. It existed in Nablus. Clinton informed others that Arafat told him there was no trace of a temple on the Temple Mount. Arafat later told a delegation of Arab leaders that the temple was not in Jerusalem, but in Yemen. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Arafat's successor Mahmoud Abbas, and other Palestinian religious and political leaders have similarly denied the existence of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. This is part of a historical erasure that is being done by the enemies of Israel and the enemies of truth. Israel's political culture is famously rambunctious, vibrant, contentious, and at times heated. The disagreements are often intense. Many Israelis are self-critical and sometimes rightfully so. The current government includes Itamar Ben-Gvir, a disciple of the infamous extremist Meir Kahan, in the words of my Atlanta colleague Yair Rosenberg, and Bezalel Smotrich, who wants to turn Israel into a theocracy. The rise of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir is emblematic of a fundamental shift in Israeli politics. The extreme has entered the mainstream, according to Rosenberg. Their dehumanizing attitude toward Palestinians is abhorrent. Excuse me. Until 2020, Ben-Gvir hung a portrait in his home of Baruch Goldstein, the man who massacred 29 Palestinian worshippers and wounded 150 at the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron in 1994. Israel's political and religious leaders condemned Goldstein. We say to this horrible man and to those like him, you are a shame on Zionism and an embarrassment to Judaism, then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin told the Knesset. I know ardent supporters of the Jewish state who have been quite troubled by the Israeli government's settlement policy. Many of them have long favored a two-state solution, the kind offered by Ehud Barak in 2000 and by Ehud Olmert in 2008, and rejected by Arafat and Abbas. Israelis themselves are critical of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Only 15% want Netanyahu to stay in office after the war on Hamas in Gaza ends, according to one recent poll. And many of them filled the streets to oppose his efforts at judicial reform. Some Israelis also oppose the Israel Defense Force's military tactics in Gaza, though it's necessary to point out that Hamas's barbaric attacks triggered this war. Hamas is inviting civilian casualties by using Palestinians as human shields. And if Israel were to cripple or eliminate Hamas, it wouldn't destroy a truly malevolent terrorist group. A New York Times investigation recently uncovered new details showing a pattern of rape, mutilation, and extreme brutality against women in the attacks on Israel. These days, I found myself thinking of Yossi Klein Halevi, the author of Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, a beautiful and evocative book that seeks mutual understanding between Israelis and Palestinians. In a recent interview with New York Times' Ezra Klein, Halevi said, "On the one hand, I believe that a Palestinian state is an existential need for Israel, and I also believe it's an existential threat, especially given what we've just experienced on October 7th. I have enormous sympathy for Halevi, and I have enormous sympathy for Palestinians raised in refugee camps who have suffered, including one who told Halevi, 'We both have legitimate claims.' If only the Palestinian leadership since 1948 had embraced that view, the whole modern history of the Middle East would have unfolded differently, far more peacefully, far more justly. In any event, those who believe that Israel is prosecuting the war against Hamas in a way that's deeply regrettable yet necessary, who know that the leader of Hamas in Gaza said that October 7th was just a rehearsal, and yet concede that the moral calculus of this war, the balancing of means and ends, is agonizing, can still weep for the deaths of the children and the innocent in Gaza. The loss of life all around is horrifying. But what Israel asks and what Israel deserves is to be judged by a reasonable standard, not a double standard, not by a standard of behavior that, in the words of my late friend Charles Krauthammer, is not just equal to that of the West, but in fact far higher than that of any Western country in similar circumstances. My reading of the record is that Israel, although certainly imperfect, has navigated extraordinarily difficult circumstances in astonishingly admirable ways. Whether you agree with my assessment or not, Israel certainly deserves a fair account of its history, rather than a distortion of it. When the distortion is done as part of a larger effort to unfairly undermine support for, or even to demonize, the Jewish state, then those of us who are non-Jews should speak up. Peace and reconciliation are the goals, but they will come only when Palestinians and their supporters, including Christians who should acquaint themselves with the history of their own faith, recognize that Jews are also indigenous to the land once called Judea." Well, these two articles today were a little bit longer than average, and that's all the time we have. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.